From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Foreign Edition. Now, Mary Kissel.
Global currency markets are wobbly. Is Pakistan the next crisis, or will Beijing step in to save the day? And more information on the extraordinarily horrific political crackdown in China's Xinjiang province. Welcome to Foreign Edition. I'm Mary Kissel at the Wall Street Journal editorial board, buffeted but not broken by a migraine today. Hugo Restall, my friend and colleague on the editorial board, stops for no man, so I hauled myself in for him. Hugo, joining from an undisclosed location in Asia Pacific. Hello, Hugo.
Hi, Mary. It's great to be with you, and sorry to hear about your migraine.
Well, it happens. Lots to think about, and we are thinking about markets today. Very, very jittery. A lot of reaction to the Trump administration's financial sanctions on Iran and threatened sanctions on Turkey. We've seen a lot of emerging market currencies tumbling, the ruble, the rial, the lira. But you are thinking about Pakistan. Why?
Yep. Well, I think this is another potential clash. If I could set the scene a little bit, I mean, Pakistan is a country that's been in financial trouble many, many times, and it's facing another crunch at the moment. Its foreign exchange reserves have dwindled. And at this point, it would normally go to the IMF for a bailout package. But the new parliament faces a fight between the U.S. and China over how to deal with this crisis. Essentially, Pakistan has saddled itself with a lot of Chinese debt to pay for these extravagant infrastructure projects under the umbrella of something called the CPEC. It's the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor. And that has contributed to the crisis. And the U.S. is expressing reluctance to approve an IMF deal that would essentially bail out Beijing for these loans that it has saddled Pakistan with. At this point, the new government has to make a decision about whether it will go to the IMF and accede to American demands that it reveal all the terms of the loans from Beijing, or whether it will try instead go to Beijing for a bailout and essentially go down the road of becoming more of a satellite of China.
Well, you know, a lot to unpack here, but at its core, Hugo, it sounds like just two fundamentally different approaches to using economic policy as a tool of foreign policy. The United States, the West, trying to go in and open up nations like Pakistan, reform them, improve their institutions and their rule of law, liberalize the markets so that they can stand on their own and become prosperous on their own. And that's worked in a lot of places in Asia. You know, think of the Asian tigers and how they developed in the 90s, places like Thailand or Taiwan, even Korea. But on the other hand, you have China using economic development as a tool, I think, and maybe I'm going too far here, as a tool of oppression, where they hook countries like Pakistan on debt, get them to build ports at Gwadar and build big bridges and roads that they can't afford or they may not need, just to link them to Beijing, to make them dependent, Hugo. Am I overstating this?
No, I think that's exactly right. And the U.S. officials have been forthright about saying that this is a new form of economic imperialism being practiced by China. I mean, it's been called debt trap diplomacy. Essentially, the U.S. had a lot of leverage to when it gave an IMF bailout package to ask countries to undertake structural reforms. And countries have another option, which is to go to Beijing and avoid those tough reforms. And that benefits the corrupt officials, but it hurts the ordinary people of the country in the long run because the reforms don't get done and the country is mortgaged to Beijing and has to give up its strategic assets. The classic example here is Sri Lanka, which in recent years, it took $6 billion in debt from China to build this incredible port and airport complex, Kota, which has received very little traffic both at the airport and the port. And so the country was unable to service the debt and had to turn over the facilities to China on a 99-year lease. And so China has now got a strategic port on the Indian Ocean, and Sri Lanka is still saddled with a lot of debt to China. So what we want to avoid is Pakistan going down that path. Question is, what's the best way to do it?
Yeah, well, let me read you a quote from Secretary of State Mike Pompeo late last month, commenting on the situation. He said, quote, "There's no rationale for IMF tax dollars and associated with that American dollars that are part of the IMF funding for those to go to bail out Chinese bondholders or China itself," end quote. So, Hugo, Mike Pompeo, the Trump administration, they're accountable to American taxpayers and American voters. And so Pompeo is essentially saying, I'm not going to go bail you out, Islamabad, if you're taking money from our enemy in Beijing, sorry, strategic competitor, whoops. And so, you know, if China wants to make these kinds of investments, they're going to have to suffer the consequences if those investments go bust. But, you know, Hugo, if that isn't accompanied by a second push, in other words, I think Mike Pompeo is essentially pushing him into Beijing's hands unless the United States can tempt Pakistan into our orbit in some other fashion.
Right. I think that's the crucial point you've put your finger on. We don't want to absolutely cut off Pakistan. We do want to use our leverage to ensure that Pakistan does make some changes. One of the key demands, as I said, is that we want Pakistan to publish the terms of the loans it has taken from China. The Wall Street Journal did some very good reporting where it publicized the terms of some loans to Pakistan for a power plant. The repayment terms were absolutely outrageous. I mean, Pakistan has to pay a very high rate of interest to China, as high as 34% on one of these power plants. And it has to pay it back in dollars, so there's no currency risk for the Chinese. So if the Pakistani people knew about the terms of these loans, it's a safe bet that they would be very upset and possibly change the trajectory of Pakistan's relationship with China. And that can pave the way for a new IMF bailout and a more reasonable terms for going forward with Pakistan's economic reforms.
Well, the other question too is what happens in the domestic political environment in Pakistan, because the incoming Prime Minister Imran Khan is kind of an iconoclast, more inclined to lean toward China. But, you know, there are still opposition parties there. The Pakistan Muslim League Nawaz, the Pakistan People's Party, and a distant third. Hugo, by no means is there unanimity there within the country.
Right. And Imran Khan is a very mercurial character. So it's impossible to predict which way he would jump on this. I think if Pakistan did fall into China's orbit, there would be problems long term, because Pakistani nationalists, you know, would not welcome the country becoming essentially a vassal state of China.
No, they certainly wouldn't. We're talking about Pakistan, and you're listening to Foreign Edition from The Wall Street Journal.
WSJ Special Access gives you a front row seat to some of The Wall Street Journal's most exciting content, like The Quirkier Side of Life, a new series that features the fun, surprising stories our reporters come across.
The chief executive walks 10,000 barefoot steps every day. He recalls stepping on a bee, which put him off earthing for a couple of days, but he got back to it.
Check out The Quirkier Side of Life on WSJ Special Access, only for WSJ subscribers.
Drive time, gym time, anytime. Podcasts from The Wall Street Journal. Check out all our shows at wsj.com/podcasts. That's wsj.com/podcasts. From the opinion pages of The Wall Street Journal, this is Foreign Edition. Now, Mary Kissel.
Welcome back, Mary, in New York with Hugo Restall somewhere out there in an undisclosed location in Asia Pacific. And we're turning to another murky locale, China's Xinjiang province in the northwestern part of China. It's home to a large ethnically Muslim population, the Uyghurs, Muslim minority rather. And we're hearing reports of internment camps, Chinese internment camps, to, quote, re-educate this population to be more loyal to the Chinese Communist Party. We've done a couple of podcasts on this subject within the last several months, but the crackdown has intensified, and we thought it would be worth bringing you the latest news from this, frankly, a tragedy that I think the world should be paying far more attention to. Hugo, what's the latest?
Well, we're getting more information about the conditions in these camps, where essentially Muslims are being detained en masse, as many as a million at a time. That's almost 10% of the Uyghur population in Xinjiang, and also Kazakhs, ethnic Kazakhs, who are a smaller minority. A few of them have, after they're released from the camps, have managed to flee abroad and have talked to journalists and scholars about the conditions there. Essentially, they face morning to night brainwashing sessions in which they're forced to chant patriotic slogans, renounce Islam, say how foolish they were to have believed in the Quran, and anyone who resists, you know, faces physical abuse, torture, solitary confinement. And so this has started to have, as this information has come out, it started to provoke an international reaction. Some U.S. lawmakers have spoken out on this. We had Marco Rubio writing on our pages last Friday.
From the great state of Florida.
Calling for sanctions.
Senator from the great state of Florida.
Yes, of course. Calling for sanctions on the Chinese officials who are responsible for this under, you know, a similar arrangement to the Ski Act for Russia. You know, this is all extremely positive. But, you know, as we've discussed before, the level of oppression and surveillance in Xinjiang is just incredible. These are, you know, measures that China under Xi Jinping is starting to roll out in the rest of the country as well, which should make us very concerned about the dark path that China is going down.
And, you know, Xinjiang never got the attention, Hugo, that Tibet had, because I feel like Tibet had the Dalai Lama and it had international attention because you had this very sympathetic, wonderful man. I've met him many years ago in exile in India. Who could talk about Tibet and the oppression there and really rally people to the cause. Of course, there were celebrities attached to that. Richard Gere comes to mind. But Xinjiang never had an advocate like that, even though it suffered many of the same kinds of repression that the Tibetans suffered. And notable, too, Hugo, that Beijing seems to be snapping up anybody who could potentially step into that role. I noted in our editorial, by the way, there is an editorial titled The Repression of the Uyghurs. It's just out. It's up on WSJ.com. Go find it. I'd note in that editorial, a very prominent academic has been missing now since December. We're only now learning of this mystery of what's happened to her. So it looks like China has learned from the Tibetan experience, and they'll just take anybody who they think could step into that international role as a kind of a symbolic spokesperson for that population, and they're just going to lock them up.
Right. There was an academic, Uyghur academic in Beijing, Ilam Toti, who was a similar situation, a very moderate voice. He was sentenced to several years in prison. So you're absolutely right that China is taking out anyone who could be a spokesman for the Uyghur people. And the saddest thing, I think, is that Islamic countries are not speaking up for the Uyghurs. In the past, Turkey would occasionally make some noises, but no longer. And essentially because of economic concerns and not wanting to anger Beijing, nobody is speaking out forcefully on behalf of the Uyghur people.
Hugo, what can be done here? You mentioned Florida Senator Marco Rubio and others, even the United Nations, is starting to make noises and complain about this, call for an investigation and more information to be made public. But you have in the White House an administration that sometimes speaks up on behalf of human rights. Let's give them their due. There is a ambassador for religious freedom, Sam Brownback, in the State Department, who's been doing heroic work on behalf of oppressed religious minorities. We have a commission on religious freedom that often writes for our op-ed pages that speaks out. But you know, what about having the president say something? or the vice president, but preferably Trump, because his words would have meaning and they would be heard within China. He'd be speaking over the Chinese leadership to the oppressed people of China. Are there plans to do that? Have you heard any noises about that from the administration?
I have not. The State Department has made some noises about the possibility of sanctions on individual officials. I should say Mike Pence did make a few remarks condemning China's treatment of the Uyghurs some time back, but it has not been done in a very high-profile manner. Clearly, human rights have been downgraded since the Obama administration to basically the lowest priority in the U.S.-China relationship. And I think it is time that that was corrected and human rights were brought back to a higher position and were mentioned, you know, at every opportunity when the relationship is broached and when officials go to China or Chinese officials come to the U.S. Some academics are talking about a Xinjiang pledge, which is that, you know, all academics who deal with China, when they give public remarks, they will preface their remarks with a few sentences about the oppression in Xinjiang, to bring that to light and combat the tendency towards self-censorship, which is also very prevalent in the academic world. So these kinds of measures could be helpful.
And as you say, Hugo, we're not talking about human rights just for human rights' sake, although, of course, I am a bleeding heart liberal when it comes to things like this. It's true. I believe everyone has rights as an individual, as a human being. But we're talking about it because it tells you something very important about the nature of the regime in Beijing that the United States is dealing with. They can talk all they want about a peaceful rise, but if they can't trust their own citizens, and if they're doing this to their own citizens, then how can we ever trust them to keep their word to us? And, I love that idea of the academic pledge because, as you say, the urge to self-censorship is high in almost every community that touches China. If you're a business person, you need a license. If you're a journalist, you need a visa to get into regions like this. If you're an academic, you need permission to get into archives. So there are a lot of levers that the Communist Party can pull to kind of try to manipulate people into keeping quiet. But it's very important that we don't.
Yeah, and recognize the nature of the Xi Jinping regime. I mean, countries that put their minority peoples into what are essentially concentration camps inevitably will also try to foment nationalism against external enemies as well. And that leads to foreign adventurism and aggression against their neighbors. And we see that with the Xi Jinping regime flexing its muscles in the South China Sea and encroaching on the rights of the other countries in that region. So we cannot just be complacent that these kinds of abuses will be confined to domestic targets. This kind of regime will inevitably become aggressive as well.
Well, that's an appropriately gloomy note to end on, as we are wont to do on Foreign Edition. So let's stop there. All my thanks to Hugo Restall out there in Asia. Thanks for joining, Hugo. And on behalf of me, Mary Kissel, please email us and tweet to us, preferably tweet to us, at Mary Kissel and at Hugo Restall. We read every single thing you send to us. Thanks for listening. I'll be back with you on Wednesday.